From WAMC in Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly magazine about New York State government and politics. Your host is David Gastina, with political commentary by Dr. Alan Shartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Coming up this week, a deeper look at the Moreland Act Commission. Our political observer, Alan Shartok, will share his thoughts on Elliot Spitzer's return to politics, and will travel to an urban farm in Buffalo. Those stories and more on the Legislative Gazette. Governor Andrew Cuomo's Moreland Act Commission to investigate the legislature is not the first time a governor created a panel to probe state lawmakers. In fact, Cuomo's own father did it a quarter century ago with mixed results. We get more from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
When Andrew Cuomo's father, Mario Cuomo, was governor back in the 1980s, he also called on the powers in the now 100-year-old Moreland Act to appoint a commission to look into government corruption. It was chaired by the respected former Fordham Law School dean, John Feerick, and it issued several reports with recommendations for change. They were widely praised at the time by reform groups and newspaper editorials. In fact, the proposals were so good that groups like the League of Women Voters are still drawing on them to this day, says the League's Barbara Bartoletti.
The lax campaign finance laws that we have, from everything from the loophole, the what we call the LLC loophole, the high contribution limits, all the way down.
But, Bartoletti says, that's just the problem. While the Feerick Commission was successful in documenting the campaign fundraising system's problems and recommending ways to improve it, it failed in actually persuading the state legislature to adopt the vast majority of the proposals. Governor Andrew Cuomo has appointed a panel that includes many of the state's district attorneys. They'll be probing the campaign filings at the State Board of Elections. Bartoletti says the Elections Board, made up of two Democrats and two Republicans, has not attempted to even enforce current campaign filing laws in years.
Which does nothing except produce gridlock when it comes to campaign finance. And in fact, right now, they have no enforcement at all to actually do that.
Bartoletti, who is an advisor to the new Moreland Act Commission, says she hopes this generation's panel has a better track record. Bruce Jory, political consultant and SUNY Albany professor, says despite some of the governor's rhetoric, the commission will not function like a U.S. attorney's office and hand up indictments and reveal shocking charges.
The first thing we ought to disabuse people of is the notion that a Moreland Act commission is functionally a prosecutorial body.
Although if the commission finds any blatant criminal wrongdoing, it can forward it to the district attorneys for prosecution. Jory says the commission can be an effective tool, if used right, to get the legislature to respond to the reforms this time around.
The inherent opportunity of any Moreland Act commission is that through its broad investigatory powers, it puts together a report that basically enables the governor to get in the bully pulpit and be persuasive to public opinion and mobilizes that public opinion in a way that moves the legislature to act.
Bartoletti says the current climate of corruption, which has resulted in the indictment, resignation, or imprisonment of 35 senators and assembly members in the past decade, including several in 2013, has raised public awareness. And she agrees that New Yorkers, who recently told the Siena poll that cleaning up corruption was their number one priority, will have to keep the pressure on their elected officials in the 2014 election season in order to persuade the legislature to change a system that she says provides incumbents with many benefits.
The public has to get so fed up that they decide they have to force their elected representatives to change the culture in Albany. That's the only way this is going to happen.
Bartoletti hopes the majority of lawmakers who are clean will have incentive to sign on so they aren't tainted by the seemingly constant scandals. Jory says the governor has to be careful of just one thing, though, that he doesn't go too far and alienate the legislature completely or use it to try to settle political scores.
If he alienates the legislature but has public opinion at his back and uses the issue to win a resounding reelection victory, that has a way of replenishing political capital.
But Jory says for any governor to ultimately win changes from a Moreland Act Commission probe is a heavy lift. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Well, the signatures are in hand. In fact, 27,000 signatures, over 27,000, Eliot Spitzer has turned in to run for controller of the city of New York.
Well, that's right. Spitzer's got a lot of guts. He knows how to do this. He looks it in the eye, and he goes ahead and does it. Now, he is going to really tick off the establishment. They're not going to like this at all. Clearly, he has used his money to do this, number one. Number two, clearly he has shown that there's a real appetite for his return. And I think part of that, David, is the fact that people know he's going to mix it up and make it interesting. And that's the one thing you don't see in politics most of the time. You see the sort of regular. And Spitzer does not have the regulars on his side. So he had to collect a lot of signatures. Now, when I was a young man, very young, I was interning for a state senator. And they sent me down to the Varick Street election headquarters at the time, I believe, to check signatures because somebody was running in a primary and they wanted that person out of there. And I really learned so much. I was only there one day. But what happened was you would look up the signature page and what somebody signed. And if they left out their middle initial, they were kicked off. If the address was wrong in any way whatsoever, if the zip code was wrong, if anything at the time was wrong, that petition was invalidated. So they play this with a vengeance. You know that you have to have at least three times as many in order to make it work. But Spitzer was so smart. He had a petition signing party. He paid people to go out and do it. Money talks, all others walk, no two ways about it. But I also think it shows that there is a tremendous appetite to have a meaningful race here. I think this is a pretty good indication that he's going to win when the time comes. Now, Scott Stringer, who is his opponent, is a good guy. I know him. I have respect for him. But the establishment wants him. And if there's one thing about the electorate that I know, and that is they like a contest. They like to see a Horatio Alger story. They like to see a person come from behind. Now, Horatio Alger, as you will remember, had nothing. And then all the stories were about people who had nothing and ended up, you know, having a lot. Spitzer had a lot, lost a lot, and now is on his way back. And it's going to be very interesting.
Do you think, should he win this and, as you say, roil the establishment, that he'll go for a higher office?
Oh, I don't think there's any question. I don't think there's any question about it. And I think they know that, too. You know, when you're looking at the potential for support, I don't see it. In other words, who's supporting the guy from regular political office? This is something they don't want. This is not only good news for him, but it's potentially very good news for Anthony Weiner, who is running for mayor, you know, and who had his own scandal. And I happen to think that big part of this is redemption. People believe that everybody deserves a second chance. They believe that they have done things that they would rather not see in the New York Times, and their children have done things that they might not want to see in the New York Times, and they don't like this sort of condescending, you sinned and therefore you never get up again. I think Eliot Spitzer has a great deal to offer the people because he's smart. And we saw what he did when he was attorney general, and he really riled the establishment, especially on Wall Street and some of the rats there. And I think this is going to scare an awful lot of people. I wouldn't be surprised to see them go after him in other kinds of ways. You may remember that when he resigned, there was all this talk that somebody might prosecute him. He's spitting in their eye. And when you spit in the eye of Wall Street, when you spit in the eye of the political establishment, let me tell you, people get pretty riled.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina.
A Republican representative from New York and a Vermont Democratic congressman have teamed up and submitted legislation that would restrict U.S. involvement in Syria. The two were on C-SPAN this week to discuss their bill. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley has more.
H.R. 2494, titled the Protecting Americans from the Proliferation of Weapons to Terrorists Act, would prohibit any funding to the Central Intelligence Agency, the Department of Defense, or any other intelligence entity that would directly or indirectly support military or paramilitary operations in Syria. It would cease to apply only if a joint resolution approving assistance is enacted by Congress. On Wednesday morning, the bill's sponsors, New York Republican Representative Chris Gibson of the state's 19th District and Vermont Democratic Congressman-at-Large Peter Welch, appeared together on C-SPAN's Washington Journal program. Welch, who is a member of the Oversight and Government Reform National Security Subcommittee, says their legislation basically means if the president wants to arm the Syrian rebels, he cannot do it without congressional approval.
Chris and I feel very strongly Congress has to be involved in that discussion.
New York's Gibson, a member of the Armed Services Committee and retired U.S. Army colonel, says arming rebels would be a very serious escalation.
If another country was to arm rebels for the purpose of attacking our country, we would view such action as an act of war. I do not think it's wise to arm the rebels. I oppose military intervention, most certainly. Before any of that takes place, there should be a voice for the American people through their representatives.
Both congressmen are concerned that a military intervention could backfire and escalate U.S. involvement in the conflict.
If we arm these rebels, we will exacerbate the situation. We will not resolve it. We will make it worse. And we also make ourselves responsible for this civil war.
What they're proposing is that we take military action, and they don't address the downside and the complexity of taking military action when we Americanize that civil war. Incidentally, arming the rebels is not going to change the military equation.
And then if we talk about further escalation, we have to believe that the other actors involved here are going to take similar tactic, which means that we're heading for a longer-term stalemate, and then we'll be drawn into this. And this is not in our interest.
The program took questions from callers and via Twitter, including Republican David from White Lake in Sullivan County, a constituent of Congressman Gibson.
I think that it is absolutely disgusting that the United States is intervening there. We have no business intervening in Syria.
The complexity with this concept really concerns me. Having done this work, how difficult it is to establish logistical base, to be able to vet people we're going to support, how difficult it is then to go through the training.
All while you're getting shot at.
Potentially getting shot at, yeah, 120-degree heat. The efficacy of this is dubious at best. And the situation in Syria is very murky. I don't think that this is going to resolve the matter. Arming these rebels will make it worse, not better, and we can't afford it.
Washington Journal host Greta Bronner read a tweet posed to the duo.
Steve Tranquility tweets in, how do we know the CIA has not already sent arms to the rebels in Syria? And if so, what are the consequences?
Well, they probably have. When I was traveling in the region, the CIA was very, very aggressive in wanting to be able to arm the rebels. But I suspect the CIA has been doing some of that.
If that were true, I'd be outraged. The Constitution is very clear. It's the people's representatives who make decisions such as these. We are urging caution. We say that there must be a vote first. The American people get a voice. And we say no to war with Syria.
By the way, no one told us in the CIA or anywhere else that there was actual arming going on. But I think all of us know that the CIA does things in secret, so we don't know what they were doing.
The bill's restriction does not apply to funding for non-lethal humanitarian assistance for the Syrian people. The Senate version of the bill is co-sponsored by Democrat Tom Udall of New Mexico, Mike Lee, Republican of Utah, Connecticut Democrat Chris Murphy, and Kentucky Republican Rand Paul.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
Citizen justice advocates are showing solidarity with those they believe are unjustly imprisoned. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas explains.
Yassin Naref, the Albany imam convicted of material support for terrorism along with pizzeria owner Mohammed Hussein after a 2006 FBI sting, is preparing to file a new appeal asking for a new trial. This after Naref discovered significant new evidence about his case. Kathy Manley is with the law firm Kindlin Shanks.
The government had claimed that Yassin was in Al-Qaeda and that he was somebody named Mohammed Yassin. Yassin got this information from a FOIA request of the FBI in late 2011, and it showed that they thought he was this other guy. And this guy got killed by a missile strike in 2010, and so it was absolute proof that he wasn't him, which they should have known much sooner, actually. So we're filing a new motion saying that the whole case was predicated on this wrong identification of Yassin as somebody in Al-Qaeda. And also, it was at the time, 2002, 2003, when they were desperately looking for any connection between Al-Qaeda and Iraq. And Yassin's Iraqi, and so they were using him to make that connection, we think. And it was totally false.
Manley says the evidence was apparently shown to the trial judge and the appeal court, but not to either the defense attorneys or to the jury at trial. Project Salam's Lynn Jackson is circulating an online petition that asks the judge who would hear the appeal, Honorable Thomas McAvoy, who was also the Naref Hussein case trial judge, to give it serious consideration. Saturday, Jackson will set out on a 133-mile walk from Albany to Binghamton to deliver a petition to support the motion for a new trial.
The reason that I decided to hand-deliver the signatures on the petitions to the judge's court is because I felt like we needed to make a statement to let the judge know that people here in Albany really care about Yassin Naref and about the Naref Hussein case. And I felt that walking for this distance is an extremely peaceful way of expressing our concern about the case and our interest in the case. And also what it does is it allows a lot of opportunity to meet a lot of other people and to let them know about this particular case. I'm sure the judge is going to make a very fair decision no matter what.
Jackson expects to arrive in Binghamton the morning of Tuesday, July 23rd. Naref is serving his 15-year sentence at the low-security federal prison in Loretto, Pennsylvania. His release date is October 2018. Meanwhile, Brendan Maslauskas Dunn is involved with Citizen Action and Occupy Utica in the organization of a series of protests in Utica Friday and Saturday in solidarity with 30,000 inmates involved in a hunger strike in California.
It's specifically against solitary confinement in California's prisons, which has been called a form of torture by the international community. There are prisoners in California's prisons who are involved in this hunger strike, some of whom have been in solitary confinement. That's in a tiny cell for over 20 years. Some of them haven't even been outside. They have not had any human contact with anyone. Solitary confinement only exists to break people psychologically, mentally, and physically. And so we will be picketing outside of the parole office this Friday, and having what unions used to call a flying picket. We'll be going to dropping banners and holding signs outside of all the local jails and prisons in Utica.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas. Listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. As urban farms become a familiar feature of many large cities, they're also presenting a challenge for zoning laws and regulators. The Innovation Trail's Ashley Hassett reports now on the story behind Buffalo's second urban farm as the east side of the city looks at how to handle more farms in the future.
For a moment, you feel like you're in one of the most rural parts of upstate New York, listening to the serene sounds of birds and insects. But a few minutes later, a police car barrels by as a friendly reminder that you're in the city.
The land was owned by the railroad company for about 100 years.
Newlyweds Daniel and Alex Ash live in an old two-story house on Guitry Street, located on the east side of Buffalo, where they lease 6 acres. It's their first year running their own urban farm.
Somebody at some point, we think about 40 to 50 years ago, planted about 25 apple trees, a couple pear trees, and 3 or 4 cherries. And, you know, they haven't been maintained for at least a decade, if not more. And so we're looking to bring those back into production.
Alex Ash came to Buffalo with her parents, Mark and Janice Stevens, 5 years ago from rural Wyoming County. The Stevens family owned the other urban farm on the east side, a few blocks away on Wilson Street. Alex and Daniel attribute all of their farming knowledge to their parents.
Another important thing that has been successfully passed down is that they feel that they can do these things. They can do whatever they want to.
Janice and Mark Stevens say they started farming because they didn't want to grocery shop for things they could grow themselves. They also used farming to teach their children life lessons.
I would use the example of potatoes. From the littlest kid who was like spacing out the potatoes with their feet to the ones who were, you know, tamping it over, and then when it came to harvest time, we all did that together. We dug up the potatoes, we sorted them, we stored them in the basement, and they would feed us all winter long. And they knew that they were an integral part of that process.
With the younger Stevens children digging holes for bean plants as part of their summer project, Daniel Ash talks about why soil is usually a big concern for urban farmers.
If the area that you're growing has been historically residential, you're more likely to have issues with soil fertility and low levels of organic matter. And they demolish houses, they bring in loose fill that's low quality, and you're basically having to start from scratch in terms of building your soil.
Ash says he and his wife got lucky with their soil because the land they lease has never been developed. Mark Stevens says the city location has other benefits.
We lived in a large dairy farming community, and we were the only really organic people surrounded by large farmers. So we were constantly worrying about the chemicals they were spraying, what our well water was bringing up, because all those chemicals were leaching down in airplanes flying over to spray the corn. So we don't worry about that here.
Alex Ash says that's not the only difference between rural and urban farming.
There's a lot of positive feedback. People are like, whoa, this is a great thing you're doing. But other people are like, farm in the city? No, farms belong in the country.
Mark Stevens says they also made the move so they could share their love of farming with others. He says they're working with a local co-op called Farmer Pirates.
So we're sharing equipment. We have a tractor that we have access to. We have various tillers that we share, lawnmowers. We share knowledge, and the cooperative now owns some land that is leased to its members.
Composting is another business sideline for the co-op, as Daniel and Alex pick up ingredients from the local equestrian center, neighbors, and other businesses. Buffalo has been suffering from a declining population, leaving most homes and lots on its east side vacant and run down. City Common Council member David Franczak says that's why he supports the two urban farms in his district.
You're not going to build houses in every lot. At one point, some developers said, well, we might want to build. Well, we got plenty of streets with a lot of empty lots where you can build, because this is a great experiment, and I think it's been a big success.
Alex Ash says she and Daniel plan to bring chickens, roosters, and maybe even goats to their urban farm in the future.
I would love to get animals. We want to start working with the city on that soon.
Council member Franczak says right now goats aren't allowed, but he'd be open to the idea if it's done properly.
We're a city, we're not a farm, but it's a city that has emptied out more than half its population, and on the east side, a lot more than that. So if there's ways to do it in a way that of a high standard, it's something we can look at, because we do allow chickens.
Mark and Janice Stevens say the future looks good for their city farm and others like it. In Buffalo, I'm Ashley Hassett for the Innovation Trail.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. Copies are available. Call 1-800-323-9262. That number, 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1328, or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gastina.
Statewide distribution for the Legislative Gazette is made possible by New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength is Not for Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.